Okay, thank you. Good evening, sons and daughters. My name is Bruce Morrison, and I'm an alcoholic. And thank you for the privilege of allowing me to be here. I was born 63 years ago in Nova Scotia, and as of yesterday, I have enjoyed 16 years of sobriety. And for that, I'm grateful. And I owe that all to Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12-step recovery program that I found in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. They tell us that we're supposed to share in a general way what I used to be like, what happened to me, and what I'm like today. And if I can do that in such a way that it's interesting enough, that it'll make you say, geez, I think I'll go to another meeting, then I've probably done my job. Because I know very little about very little. I know a little bit about drinking, and this whole deal is all about booze and God. So I will try to do the best I can to share my experience, strength, and hope, they say, but sometimes it's inexperience, weakness, and despair. But anyway, I'm going to share it with you all anyway, because it says that the 43 stories in the back of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous show you how these people establish a relationship with a power greater than themselves. And that's the reason that I'm here, and I suspect it's the reason most of a lot of you are here, that you're powerless over alcohol. And I didn't know that. I didn't know that. I thought I drank because I wanted to. And I never could get it right, but I kept thinking that I could. And it says in our book that the great obsession of every abnormal drinker is that someday he'll be able to control and enjoy his drinking. And I have absolutely no problem relating to that. Like I say, I was born a long time ago, it seems, in the uncharted interior of Nova Scotia, where drinking just seems to be something that slips up on you, I guess. I came from a good family. Mom and Dad weren't drinkers. Kid brother and kid sister, they had no problem with alcohol, and it might be genetic, I don't know. If you check out the cousins and the uncles and aunts, and maybe they were, maybe they didn't. I just know that I got it. So where it came from, it's like the lottery, I guess. I just got it. I don't know if I'm supposed to have it or shouldn't have had it or poor me or any of that stuff. I don't know. I just got alcoholism. And it damn near killed me. I went to school, and in school, I thought I was small. I guess I was smaller than the rest. I don't know, but I felt that way. I was quite an intelligent young fellow, I guess, because I didn't have much competition in school. I went through, so my intelligence was just there. I was smarter than most of the guys and as smart as most of the girls. And that presented me with my first dilemma, because if I was too smart, then big guys would kick the shit out of me. And if I was too stupid, the teacher would embarrass me, or my parents would be disappointed. So I was always trying to be smart enough, but not too smart. Trying to be stupid, but not too dumb enough, you know. So we hear in Alcoholics Anonymous, like, we just get some balance in my life. Well, I've never had any balance in my life, ever. And I do believe that the balance I have in my life today is just an ability to not react to the unexpected, I guess, because there is never much balance in my life. I have an ordinary life, but to me it seems extraordinary. Why? Because I follow what they say in Alcoholics Anonymous, one day at a time. When I get up in the morning, I make a contact with the power greater than myself, and when I go to bed at night, I say goodnight. And that they talk about having a relationship in AA, and that's kind of the relationship that I have. If God is my understanding, and I have no problem talking about my higher power as God, I like to develop a relationship with that power. And I get up in the morning and if I was living with anyone, if I get up in the morning, I'd probably say good morning to you. And I think that is decency and respect for the power that saves my life is what I do. Back to the old school thing, I guess I was restless, irritable, and discontented ever since I can remember. I didn't really fit in, or I thought I didn't, and people used to say I was a shy kid, but really I was full of fear. Fear that you wouldn't like me, or that you would like me and expect something from me. I could hardly wait to get out of school because of this dilemma that I had going for me, so I got through the 10th grade and left. Because I always believed that people had expectations of me. And if you have expectations of me, I knew damn well that I'd never make it. So the thing to do is to quit before I even get halfway through. My big book tells me that we'll be amazed before we're halfway through, and I don't know where halfway through is. So I'm going to hang around till I make sure that I'm halfway through at least, because I want to be amazed. Because I've been amazed on a daily basis for the last 16 years, and for that I'm very grateful. The third step to prayer kind of tells us that we will bear witness to power and love and the way of life that Alcoholics Anonymous does, and that's what you asked me to do. I left home, not to go anywhere, but just to get away. But Jesus, I hated it there. I just didn't like it, and my feet were probably alcoholic before the rest of me, I guess, so I just had to take off when I was about 16 or so. I took off and I joined the Navy, and I've been halfway around the world and never seen a damn thing, 60 or 70 feet of every country in the free world, I think, because as soon as I'd get somewhere, I'd be overcome with fear. What are these? They're talking a different language. They look different. They wouldn't like me. And then off in the distance, I'd see a sign, Black Label or Johnny Walker or something like that, and I'd gravitate toward that sign, and that's where I'd spend my time. And I'd wander back to my little boat, and 10 or 15 trips of doing that, the boat would sail away, and I'd see from here to the end of the corridor of Spain and Barbados and Iceland, and I've been, you know, but I've never seen any more than 60 or 70 feet of it. How did this all come to be, this fear, I guess, I don't know. But I'd be at these little country dances, and I was just afraid to talk to the girls and afraid to mingle with the guys, and I'd just stand there. And I come from a little village, about 300 people in it. And I knew everybody there. I knew the parents and the kids and the grandparents. I just knew everybody. But put me in a social setting, I just froze. I just couldn't talk, and I couldn't dance, and I just was just terrified of everything. I get teased about the little village that I come from. There's 300 people in it, and it's safe. Constant. It's always 300 people. Every time a girl gets pregnant, a guy leaves town. So that's the kind of a town I come from. One night at one of these country dances, I was standing there doing a lot of thinking about what I was going to do and what I shouldn't do and what I could do. And boy, if I just had the chance, I'd do this and I'd do that. And some young hillbilly come along and handed me a jug and said, here, take a yank on this. And I did. An amazing thing happened. Man, the music sounded better, and these little flat-chested girls developed right before my eyes. Man, it was just awesome what happened to me. And I was going to take some of these girls home, and I was going to settle the score, participate in the Saturday night fight that these little villages had. And I could have done all of those things, except that I got drunk. And I woke up on my mom's lawn, and I was puking. And Dad was cursing. Mom was crying. And there I was. And I felt remorse. And guilt and shame and fear and all of those things. My first time out. And for the next 30 years, I pursued, or I woke up often with those same feelings. So after Dad quit cursing and Mom quit crying and I quit puking and the resilience of youth, I started thinking about next Saturday night. What happened was, I think, I probably drank it too fast, or I didn't drink it fast enough, or I got too excited, or I danced too much, but next Saturday night is going to be different. And I pursued that for the next 30 years. The great obsession of every abnormal drinker is that someday he'll control and enjoy his drinking. And you know, the baffling part about alcoholism is that I got it right just often enough to make me believe the lie. It tells us in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that we cannot differentiate the true from the false. We see drinks that other people take with impunity. Why do I drink? Sense of ease and comfort. I had to have ease and comfort. You guys could see that you drink normal. And me, I just couldn't tell the true from the false. Every time I drank something, well, something, I just never knew. Sometimes it was going to be great, sometimes it wasn't. I never knew if I was going to stay drinking for a day, an hour, a year. I didn't know if I was going to Wisconsin or Wyoming. You know, I just didn't know. I never knew. And the time I was 20 or so, I guess, I had decided that some responsibility would straighten me out a little bit. So I had a Mrs. Morrison and a little Morrison, and things just weren't getting any better. And that lovely lady suggested that perhaps it was the people I was hanging around with in Nova Scotia. They were just a bunch of no goods, so we should move away. And we decided to move west. So when you leave make an announcement that you're leaving the Maritimes, they have a little party, a going away party for you. Well, mine lasted 7 months. And we had a hell of a send-off for old Bruce, I'll tell you that. So by the time I got on the train, I was all hungover and whatever. And by the time I got to Three Rivers, I was drunk again. And the train conductor said, I'm putting you off at the next stop. And that was Montreal. So I really didn't move here. You're just stuck with me. That's how that all came to me. I like to say I moved to Montreal in the early 60s, but it wasn't. I just got put off the train and stayed. When you're... I've only heard this in AA meetings. I've never read it anywhere. But they tell us that the drunks are above average intelligence. We're keen intellectual alcoholics. Well, I've only heard that said by drunks in drunk meetings. I've never read that anywhere. But I figured I was one of those. And we prospered and done fairly well. I had a pretty good job. And Mrs. Morrison of that era, she had a pretty good job too. And we had money and good friends and all of that stuff. But alcohol kept whittling away at me. And alcoholism is like erosion, I guess. It keeps eating away at the coastline and you don't really notice it going. You know, things were just being eaten away from me. My ability to work hard, my ability to show up on time, and my ability to pay bills, and my respect, and my social life, and my self-esteem, and my dignity. And all these things were beginning to go away. When I was 32, I had my first opportunity to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, not because one day this group had an idea, but it was because I had an alcoholic seizure. And I collapsed, and I was foaming at the mouth, and twisting and shaking, and geez, I was embarrassed. And I was afraid. And so were my co-workers. They were afraid. They didn't know what had happened to me. And by the time I got out of the convulsion, and I suppose it only lasts a second or two, but you're twitching and shaking. When they got me to the hospital, the first thing they asked me was, do you drink? And I said, no, rarely, sometimes, periodically, or whatever. So, based on the information that I gave them, they treated me for everything that they could think of to find out why I had these things. You know, Rocky Mountain fever and syphilis, and you know, whatever. They just checked me out to see what was wrong with me. Because I never said that I drank. And really, to me, I didn't think I... drank because I've seen other people drinking with impunity. You know, what about old Grant, for Christ's sake? He drinks more than I do. And my wife would say, why don't you drink like Uncle Louie? Who in the hell wants to drink like Uncle Louie? Jesus Christ, give me a break. I like people whopped down, man. And that's what alcoholism does. It creates an illusion. It talks in the big book about that. We're delusional people. And delusional doesn't mean that we're crazy. It just means that there's a part of us missing. And the very next line talks about illusion. And I was asked one time what I thought the difference between delusion and illusion is. Well, I had to think about it for a while. But the best I can come up with is look at me. Any magician worth his weight in salt can produce something, an illusion, that you will believe. You think it's real. Well, I believed that I was taller and smarter and sexier and more fun-loving and more outgoing and hip and cool. That was me. As soon as I took a few drinks, that was the illusion. I created the illusion for myself. The delusion was that I moved into it. I really got to believe that I was much taller and much more handsomer and much more rich, much more wise, and I got to believe in these things. Hence, I began to feel, when I didn't have these feelings, that people was going to see the inadequacies of me. So I was caught up in the illusion and the delusion, not being able to tell the truth from the false. I couldn't drink because I never knew what was going to happen to me, and I couldn't stop drinking because the world became unbearable. My wife's legs got shorter, and my kids became delinquent, and the bills got bigger, and it was just horrible when I didn't drink. And you're wandering around and you're restless, irritable, and discontent. And unless, again, you can feel that sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks we see others taking with impunity. And my problem was that I was powerless over alcohol. Step one says to me, we admitted that we were powerless over alcohol. Well, geez, I never had much problem with that. You know, when you... have a few drinks and get drunk and lose your way and fall down and spend all your money, you know, powerless over alcohol, no problem. And then there's a little dash. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, dash. Our lives have become unmanageable. That little dash, to me, means my life. If you look at a headstone in most graveyards, you will see so-and-so, 19 such-and-such, dash, whatever. That little thing represents his whole life. Well, in the staff of Alcoholics Anonymous, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, dash. End of one thought, beginning of another thought. Our lives have become unmanageable. That's why I'm here. My lives were unmanageable. My emotional life, my financial life, my sexual life, my everything. My lives were unmanageable. What am I going to do? I can't drink and I can't stop. Can't live with it, can't live without it. I got a dilemma. And it talks about the dilemma in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And a dilemma, I believe, is when there's two answers for one question and both of them seem right. Two opposite answers. That was me. I can't drink, can't stop. Can't drink, can't stop. So back there, when I was 32, which was a long time ago, after I had my little twitch, I went to see the doctor of industrial medicine at the company I worked for, and he told me I was a chronic alcoholic. And the thing for me to do was to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, I don't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, well, you're in luck. That's this guy up here on the 14th floor or whatever, right here in this building, is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll introduce you. So he took me up to see this guy, and this guy had on a three-piece suit and a gold watch fob and a desk priced as big as the St. Catherine Street bus. And it just looked to me like, just, wow, look at this. I always wanted to be somebody. I always did. Thought, here's my chance. This guy looks good. So I tell him what my problem is, and my problem is booze. Yeah, he said, well, just don't drink and go to meetings. Well, that didn't sound too difficult to a keen intellectual alcoholic like myself. But I'll tell you true, in retrospect, my friends, that little piece of information damn near killed me. Because if you just don't drink and go to meetings, you will still be restless, irritable, and discontented. I was. But it starts off again, I'm willing to believe the illusion. I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I walk in the door, and here you come. Hi, good to see you. Welcome. Sit over here. Give me your phone number. Have a coffee. Jeez, I felt like somebody. And I went home and told Mrs. Morris, and I said, my God, what a wonderful bunch. That's where I'm going to spend the rest of my life. I go off to another meeting the next night, and here you come again. Hi, good to see you. Welcome. Sit over here. Give me your phone number. And I was just delighted. The third meeting I went to, I strutted in, and some new goof walked in right behind me, and you all run by me to get to him. And I felt rejected. Because you see, with alcoholism, we're sensitive folk. We are. And if you treat me average, I feel rejected. So in order for me to feel average, you've got to treat me special. That's alcoholism. That's nothing else but pure alcoholism. Alcohol would relieve all of that. I didn't give a damn what you thought of me. Because I was an inferior person with a superior attitude when I drank. And if you take the drink away, I'm just an inferior person. I hung around Alcoholics Anonymous for about 7 years. I went to meetings, quite a few at the beginning. And I would come in and I'd sit in a chair and I'd drink a few coffee and put my dollar in the cup and leave. I couldn't make no heads nor tails out of this. Because the book tells me that it's our common problem that gets us here. But it's our solution that will keep us here and allow us to stay here. When we have a solution. So when I'd come in and I would, you got tired of listening to my whining and I got tired of listening to your whining and it just seemed horrible. It was dull and uninteresting. Because I went to meetings. I never joined the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Being restless and irritable and discontent most of the time, after about 7 years sober, 8 years sober, I guess, dry, abstinent, without alcohol, whatever you want to call it, I got the bright idea that I should move the family back to Nova Scotia. And that's, my wife and daughter kind of laughed at me and said, that's simple, you don't want to do that. Well, that's all a drunk needs to pull the trigger. I said, well, the hell with you. So I quit my job, sold the house, abandoned my daughter, and divorced my wife, and moved to Nova Scotia, where I was delightfully happy. For 6 or 7 weeks, I guess. Because down there, you see, what enticed me to go down there was the contentment of it all, the ease, the laid-back attitude. Geez, I just couldn't stay away from it. After a week or so there, these people don't work here. Why are they waving at me? They don't know who the hell I am. You know, just get out of my face. And one night, my new lady friend that I had there, She told me she'd be home at 9 o'clock, and here it was 5 after 9 or something, and that bitch, you can't trust her. She's not home here. You can never depend on her. And my partner, he was out driving around in a brand new car. Money he probably stole from me. And I got into a mode of self-pity. And I really find that this is what will make most drunks drink. Self-pity. But it doesn't start off with that. They tell us that alcohol is cunning, baffling, and powerful. You see, with me, it's kind of a wheel. I get a little resentful. A little resentment I can handle. And I get two or three of them little resentments going, and I get up into anger. A little bit of anger going. So now my little wheel has moved from resentment to anger. And then it's rage. Once I get to the rage stage, the only place left to go is self-pity. And all of those years of my life, I would have resentments, and I would have anger, and I would have rage, and I would have self-pity, but I'd have a solution. Booze. You fellas took my solution away from me. My solution was always alcohol. When I got restless, irritable, and discontented, when I got full of rage, full of self-pity, have a few drinks, to hell with you. I didn't care. So here I am now, on my own. A little resentful at her and him. A little anger, I can't do nothing about it. Rage, this shouldn't be happening to me when I'm almost 40 years old. Self-pity. Oh, Jesus, you know, I should have stuck it out. Oh, Jesus, you know. And there was a bottle of whiskey there because Bruce is a good old boy. Everybody knows Bruce don't drink. Good fellow. And this bottle of whiskey, I swear to God, friends, just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and I was without defense against the first drink. And I poured a glass of that. And I realized I wasn't being too smart, but I had a plan. All drunks got a plan. Every drunk I ever met got a plan. Just no power to carry it out. Always had a plan. So I'm going to have this drink of whiskey, and tomorrow I'll go to AA. A plan. So I had a drink of whiskey, and a funny thing happened. It was much like that country dance. I became at ease with the whole world. That wonderful lady of mine, you know, she don't get out often enough. She should stay. Maybe she should go to Europe for a month or two, you know, really lay back. My partner, man, if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't have nothing. What a great guy. I wish he was here just so I could hug him. Man, he got it. Have another one. And this is the sad part of my story. Up until this point, I'd been a lot of places and had a lot of fun and entertained a lot of people and been places that I normally would never have gotten. But 7 years it took me to get back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Why? I think because when I come to the next morning, I was all ashamed and full of guilt and remorse and all of that stuff, and I'm sick. So I'll have a couple of beers. So after a couple of beers, who the hell needs Alcoholics Anonymous? So I kept postponing it. Procrastination was my game, it seemed. So I'd be good and drunk the second day and the third day and the fourth day and whatever. I always had this plan of going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And finally one day I get up enough nerve to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I go walking in the door and nobody said, "Holy Jesus, there's Bruce, he's back, good to see him, man, where are you?" Nobody said that. Because I was thinking I could start where I left off. But I really hadn't been anywhere. I just come sneaking in, sat in a chair and leave. I had no program. I had nothing. I felt like on another world when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got feeling rejected because she didn't treat me special and I had to leave. And I tried that for 7 years. I went to quite a few meetings, but I could never, ever surrender to the fact that I'm powerless over alcohol. That my lives have become unmanageable, and I could never come to believe that there's a power greater than me that could restore me to sanity, because I had the great old couple who was never sane anyway, so what are you going to do about it? Yeah. You know, all this foolishness. My own ignorance kept me, and my prejudiceness towards anything new. I think we've read tonight that we try to hold on to our old ideas. It's not really that I liked my old ideas, I was just so damn prejudiced and belligerent that I didn't want to believe that there was anything other than the way I was doing it. I couldn't believe in power greater than myself. And so finally, here in Montreal, I decided the world would be a better place without me. So I'm going to kill myself. And I haven't got enough balls to just do that. I just don't. It's messy and it's inconvenient. And it takes a lot of nerve to do that. So I devised this plan that I was going to have a unique way of killing myself. I'm going to get 2 bags of cocaine and 2 bottles of brandy, and I'm going to climb up to the top of Mount Royal, and I'm going to like that, and I'm going to pass out and die of exposure. Then the next day, it'll probably be in the Journal de Montréal, you know, good old Bruce, poor old fella, but he died, you know. Well, then they all miss me. So I'm up there, and I'm like that, and a wonderful thing happens. Much like that country dance. Much God damn what y'all beautiful city this time of day. And then I have a problem. The balance thing again. What happened? I only got two bottles and two bags. What happens if I die before it's all gone? Shit. What happens if it's all gone and I'm still living? You've got to get it just right. So I thought I'd better go home and get a coat. So I fell down the side of Mount Royal and somebody called the police on me and they shoveled me off the sidewalk. Because you're a pretty banged up mess when you come down the side of Mount Royal with the benefits of a road. You just come down through them briar bushes and stuff. Hell of a mess that they see, I'll tell you this. And they gave me an option, said, would you like to go to number one or a detox center? Well, I'm telling you, I'm a keen, sharp type of guy. I said, I'll go to the detox center. And they hauled me off to this place down in the East End that had 22 of the worst looking people I had ever seen in my entire life. They were talking to themselves, and they were bleeding and hallucinating and smelled bad, and I fit right in. And I was arrogant. I was arrogant. I asked the guy there with the white coat on, I said, what's the rules? He said, I said, what time do I have to go to bed? It's up to you. I said, what time do I have to get up? He said, I don't give a damn if you ever get up. And I knew that, or should have known that I was running out of options. Because you see, when I left home, as most of us do, I had a set of principles that should have seen me right through my life. But I had the ability to adjust my principles down to accommodate my behavior. And the worse my behavior came, the lower my principles came. So when I arrived there, I was without principle. And I had very well no other place to go. And I come back out of that detox center after 7 or 8 days and took another run at it for a while. And all of the things that we hear at Alcoholics Anonymous, don't scoff them off and say, oh, that's horse shit. Don't do that. Because someday some of these words do hang in there, and someday you will be able to use most things that you hear in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been to thousands of meetings, and I can never remember one meeting that got me sober. But I picked up a little bit here, and a little bit there, and a little bit here, and one day I put together my whole symphony. I have my own music. That is the result of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and these countless meetings that I go to where I know just about everybody and I always feel at home. And I never feel average, I always feel special. And I feel needed and part of. And that's really what the great fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. I was living in a little rat hole somewhere over near NDG and I had a half a box of beer and a half a bottle of rum and a half-baked idea and a half phone book and all of this stuff, and I was all alone. And I didn't want to get drunk and I didn't want to get sober and I didn't know what to do. And I heard you people say about prayer. And I got down on my knees and I jumped up just like that. What a stupid thing you've done. Jesus, I hope nobody's seen you do that. And I closed the blinds of all. You've gone too far now. And it seemed to me that it was 2 or 3 minutes. It might have been 2 or 3 hours, I don't know. But a guy that I had met way back when, back in 1974, he had been observing my behavior from a distance. And that night he called me, and he was crying. And he said, Bruce, I think I'm going to drink. And I said, for Christ's sake, man, come right over. Now, I don't know if I want him to come and drink with me or what. I don't know. But that's what I said. And lo and behold, being the Alcoholics Anonymous member that he was, he showed up at my door. And when he got one look at me, we solved his drink problem. I'll tell you that. That solved his problem. And he stayed and he talked with me the rest of the night. And the next morning, when he left, I was resentful for a second or two. But he left me alone on Sherbrooke Street. And something happened. I don't know what it was. But for a moment, or a second, I comprehended the word serenity and I knew peace. It only lasted a second. And I do believe if we look at the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and we look at any one of you most times, there has been a brief flash in your life where you understand serenity and you feel peace. I think that is grace. And most likely, most of you have enjoyed it, felt it, seen it over and over today and yesterday and the day before. I do believe that is grace. But most of us, it says in the big book, most of the time it's blotted out by the clamors of the outside world. So we're just not ready to receive it. Why? Because we're restless, irritable, and discontented. We're selfish and self-centered folks that always want our own way, full of resentment, full of revenge, full of whatever, expectations, disappointments. And we blot out that little bit. But that one morning, I comprehended the word serenity and I knew peace. and I didn't know what was going to happen or where I was going to go, but I knew that things were going to be all right because the fight was over. And if we look at Bill's story in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, he went to France in 1914. And he walked into Winchester Cathedral and he was much moved by a spiritual thing that he had seen. And in 1934, when he began to get sober, he said the true significance of that little experience was made clear to him. He felt lifted up. What is a spiritual awakening but feeling lifted up? And that's what I felt that morning. I felt lifted up. And every time I go to an AA meeting now, I feel lifted up. I went that morning because I had nowhere to live and my wife was gone and the kids were gone and the money was gone and the job was gone and the wolves were at the door. I walked back down to that detox center where I had been all those years before. And this time I had to beg them to let me in, and they let me in eventually. And it seemed to me it was the same 22 people there. And it seemed to me that I fit in one more time. The only thing difference was my arrogance was gone. When they showed me to my little bunk, I knelt for the second time in my life, and I was grateful to God that I had a chance to make a new beginning. The willingness to kneel gave me the ability to stand, and that's what I always keep in my heart. My willingness to kneel gave me the ability to stand. And I find in Alcoholics Anonymous that we have a chance to do things all over again. And how many times do we hear just in conversation, boy, if I only had a chance to do that again, if I could only take another stab at this or that. This is the beautiful gift, absolutely free, that Alcoholics Anonymous gives you, providing that you're willing to obey a few simple principles. In the foreword of the 12 and 12, Bill Wilson wrote that the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are a set of principles spiritual in nature. But if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and make the sufferer useful, happy, and whole. When I seen step 3, they asked me to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, and the will of God terrified the daylights out of me, because I was brought up Presbyterian, man, and I knew for sure that I was on a slow boat to hell from my mother's description of my behavior. So when I was asked to turn my will over to the care of God, I wondered what God's will would be for me. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells us God intended us to be happy, joyous, and free. What a great package. It's a great deal, Alcoholics Anonymous. The chance to do it all over again. I told you I had abandoned my wife and my kid and all of that stuff. And the new lady I met, she had two little girls that had no dad. And for the father I'd never been, I had an opportunity to be a dad. And I'm the only dad that these two little girls have ever known. And I wanted to be the best damn dad I could ever be. And they love me and respect me and all of these things. And one Father's Day, I got a card that said, "Dear Dad, thanks for being a friend. Dear friend, thanks for being a dad." And that's the kind of life that God has allowed me to live in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Why? Because I got rid of all of the things that I didn't need. My lust and my greed and my ambition and my fear and my... all of those things have gone. And I'm left exactly the way that God created me. I guess no more, no less. In times of need, I've had many, many reasons, I suppose, or many excuses to go out and take a drink, but I've never found it necessary to. when things get a little out of sorts or whatever, and I'll give you a couple of little examples, I suppose, because I've been bankrupt 3 or 4 times. I know every bailiff in Montreal on a first-name basis. I've had heart surgery. I've had cancer. My little 15-year-old daughter came home one day and told us that she was pregnant. What do we do? What do we do? First thing that the old alcoholic thing crept in on me. Oh my God, what do they think of me? I've been a bad parent. Oh my God, what do they think of me? It never dawned on me what to think of her. And I asked my wife, and it was the only time we ever knelt in prayer together. And the answers came. It's her life. Ask her what she wants to do. So the three options were adoption, abortion, motherhood. She chose motherhood. So our job then was to be of all the help we can be. And really, isn't that the battle cry of Alcoholics Anonymous? Can I help you? So why should I limit it just to drugs? Can I help you? My little girl gave us a granddaughter that turned out to be the light of our life. She turned a house into a home. And it reunited the family that I had once lost or abandoned or gave up. My estranged daughter wanted to be the godmother of this little baby. My ex-wife thinks she's a grandmother too. And here we are. We're all a big tribe. And old Bruce is the chief. And isn't it marvelous? I did have a chance to do it all over again. And As long as I stay in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's always somebody new that comes along. And the greatest honor I've received in Alcoholics Anonymous is somebody comes to me and says, "Will you sponsor me? I want what you have." Well, I have nothing to give you, but you can have anything I have. I share my experience, strength, and hope with you, like I said, and I even share my inexperiences, weaknesses, and despair, because it's all part of the whole package, no more, no less. I have the same home group that I've had for 16 years. I have the same sponsor I've had for 16 years, and a whole bunch of people have trucked through my life as sponsors, and I just absolutely enjoy the freedom, the camaraderie, the wonderfulness of my life as it is today. I owe it all to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I owe it all to folks like you that put up with that new goof that come in twitching and shaking and wondering what's going on. Let me in on the inside track, man. I wanted it for nothing, but the willingness to kneel gave me the ability to stand. And the real battle cry of Alcoholics Anonymous is, "Can I help you?" Thank you.
Thank you.